Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 25th, 2005. Today's forum is entitled, A Funny Thing Happened. Session number FO2005-30. Let's listen in.
We can do it in categories if we want, like, you know, church or funerals. Funerals always have good funny stories around them. And all kinds of things like that, too. So, but we'll see how it goes. And somewhere in this, we are going to have a visit from Wes Pree. And once Wes gets going, that may just take over the rest of the time. We don't know. We're going to wait for just the opportune moment. So, everybody clear on what we're going to do? I'm going to start and tell three stories.
Three.
How did you get three?
Well, because I'm in charge.
Yes.
You want to tell three? They're special stories. This year marks the 35th anniversary of the ordination of Lutheran women in North America. So I have three Lutheran women clergy stories to tell you that I heard at a conference I was at two or three years ago where we all sat around like this and told stories. And they're very good, and they're from some of the early days, and some of them, well, I'll just tell the stories. The first one is, and I was reminded of this story, when I did a funeral in Kashmir down the road here a little while ago, and the American Legion was present with the color guard and all that. So the story is, this is in the late 70s, and there really weren't very many women pastors. And this woman had just graduated from Wartburg Seminary. She didn't have a call yet. Doesn't that sound familiar? It happens now to a woman without call here. Anyway, and so she was filling in for vacations. I think it was in like rural Nebraska. And so she was, people go on vacation, she'd fill in for these guys. And she did funerals too. And this one was a graveside service only for a man who'd been a veteran. And so she was at the graveside, and she knew that the color guard was coming, so they were all there, and then the color guard, but there was a little rise, she said, just from the road up over a hill down to where the grave was. And so when you were coming up over the rise, you couldn't see what was on the other side till you got over on top of the hill. So the color guard coming up the hill couldn't see her or the grave, and they just knew the pastor was there. And none of them, it turns out, had ever seen a woman pastor before. So the guys came up over the hill, got to the top of the hill, saw her. They all sucked in their guns. And the guy carrying the flags, pants fell. So all the rest of them are rushing. And of course, you can't put the flag down. I guess nobody bothered to go rescue the flag from him. They just sort of stood there, and they just sort of floated down. They went out with it. The other funny part of this story is that in that particular American Legion post in rural Nebraska, wherever it is, the dress code now includes suspenders. So that's one story. Another story a woman told was, her husband had to have his gallbladder out, and so he had back then, you know, this is 15, 20 years ago, when he had to literally had to take open you up and take it out, not do all this magic stuff now where they blow it apart and suck it out. But so he was kind of uncomfortable, and she took the day off when he had his surgery, and he was still there the next day, and she went on her lunch hour, and this is like in the East where all the pastors wear their collars all the time. And so it's clear what she was and went in there. And he was having trouble with his incision and stuff, so she was messing around with his pajama bottoms and doing, you know, all this kind of, so God, make you more comfortable and all this stuff. And then she left. And then the other two guys in the room said, where do you go to church? She was in her first call, and her husband's also passed, and they had an apartment. I think this is like in Philadelphia or someplace. And it's one of those big urban places in the East End, I think Philadelphia. And they lived in a big apartment complex, and They also had a two-year-old kid, and she was on her way. She was chair of a city committee for the first time, and she had to go to the meeting, and she was kind of worried about the agenda, and she dashes out the house. She had to take the kid to child care. She also has to put the garbage in the dumpster and get on for meeting. So she hauls out of the house. She's got the kid in her briefcase in the garbage. She throws the garbage in the dumpster, drives down the road, takes the kid to child care, gets back in the car, looks over at her briefcase and sees the garbage.
Oh.
So where's the briefcase? It's in the dumpster. So she drives back to her apartment. And the other bad news here is that this is the day after the garbage had been picked up. So there's nothing in the dumpster. And it's one of these big, huge Hummer. You know, dumpster things behind big apartment complexes, you know, and so she said she drove, the woman that was telling it, she's a short person, you know, like maybe 5'1 or 5'2. She has to get this thing. So she drives her car up to the dumpster, gets on the hood of the car, reaches in for her briefcase and falls in the dumpster. And she also had her collar on. She said she's in the dumpster. You can't get out of those things, you know. So she's sitting there going, help! You know, waving her hand and crying for somebody to come. Finally somebody came and they looked at the dumpster and they just went. Those are three women clergy stories to commemorate the 35th anniversary of the ordination of women in North America. So, and maybe more church stories. Nobody has funny church stories?
I have a funny church story.
Okay,
go for it. It's in years. Well, it was a Sunday, and it was a special Sunday. So they decided to have this extra long procession. So instead of just going down the main aisle, they went up the main aisle, around the sides, and then came back up. And we're going to go up the steps into the chancel. And ordinarily, they just walked out the door into the chancel and sat down. Well, they get partway up the stairs, and the elastic gives away in this woman's underwear. And they fall down along her ankles. But she was so cool that she just stepped out of them.
Any other church stories? Yeah.
No, mine's a woman's story.
Okay, that'll do.
Well, this was 24 years ago, and I had just graduated from law school, which I managed to get through with the help of two study partners, Diane and Kathy. And I went to pick up my son, who was three, at the daycare. And he had a stethoscope around his neck, and he had a baby doll in front of him. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Well, I'm a nurse, and I'm fixing this baby." And I was thrilled because this daycare was obviously, you know, setting my son straight on gender identities. So we get in the car, and as I'm driving home, I said, "Well, you know, if you're not a nurse, do you think you'd like to be a lawyer like your mother?" He looked at me and he goes, "Lawyers are girls."
No.
That's true.
Hey, Bill.
I've got a...
Yeah.
Is that you, Maynard?
No, it's not Maynard Johnson. It's Robin. No. Yeah, they look a lot alike. Yeah.
This is a long story.
I got it.
Some people have heard it and some people haven't. I wrote it down because it took a while.
Okay, go for it. We're ready. Everybody ready?
All
here we
this
go.
Stuff.
Go for it. Oh, I gotta put the glasses on.
I only wanted to take a little vacation, and never in my life have I experienced such misery. It seems sometimes that misfortune seethes beneath the crust of a normal day waiting to erupt. It was the brightest days that morning of January 10th, 1983, The day was sunny, as were my expectations for a little vacation I was about to take to the vastness of the outside world from my mountain home of Holden Village, Chelan, Washington, 98816. It had rained and snowed and rained for several days prior to this sunny one, but now it seemed all too perfect for travel that morning. Six companions and I boarded a snow track at 10 a.m. for the half-hour ride to the Lake Chelan Ferry, which would take us out of the mountains. The Bombardier track, snow track hummed powerfully and ate up the first 6 miles of the 12-mile drive when suddenly in our path was an ominous avalanche blocking the road. It was huge, but brave souls that we were, we attacked it forthwith with shovel in hand and promptly leveled a trail over it for our transport. Surely our troubles were over. We loaded ourselves into the Bombardier, confident once again in our ultimate success, when what did our incredulous eyes perceive in our path but another avalanche so huge it seemed insurmountable. No doubt these slides were triggered by heavy snows and rain from the past 2 days. It looked hopeless that we could make the ferry, but being the mechanic, I elected to run 3 miles to get our G6 bulldozer, which sat at the top of the switchback grade where the road goes downhill to the ferry dock. If I got back in time with the Caterpillar, I could easily doze a road through this obstacle and we could catch our boat. Since I was slightly overweight, running through slush in 3-pound hiking boots was not a joyous thing for me to do. At least I did not see an avalanche, and all the way from my comrades to the Caterpillar, and hope for my trip still glimmered dimly in my soul. I reached the Caterpillar and began to set things in motion. True to its name, the starting engine on the Caterpillar started and the main engine roared to life. I hopped aboard like a knight on his steed to the rescue. Surely a hero was never born who struggled with mechanical failure. I raised my blade high and prepared for a headlong charge back to my stranded companions. No sooner had this thought set the gears in motion than the lift on my dozer blade lost heart and fell to earth. I felt my heart sink slightly also as I tried again. With power to spare, up went the blade, and with heart to want, again it fell to earth. It must be the clutch on the cable winch, thought I, as I rigged up some badly battered tools from the toolbox to make repairs. Sure enough, the blade lift soon had power and heart to spare, but now instead of falling down, it was constantly flying up. Back to the tools and clutch I went, and after much fine-tuning, had it going up and down of its own will. Although lamentable at best, I felt at least now it might mediate itself. With this thought in mind, I headed the beast back down the road with the blade flapping like a flag. Perhaps in response to my earnest hope, the blade ceased its pointless flapping and relinquished itself to my control. But then another calamity. There in the road where I had been only half an hour before was the most mammoth avalanche I had yet encountered. It loomed about 25 feet high and 30 yards across. With great fortitude, I lowered my stabilized blade and began the attack. It soon became apparent that at my present rate of progress, we would be lucky to make the January 13th ferry. My friends in the Bombardier had surmounted the previously insurmountable avalanche, but like myself, were left speechless at the base of this last massive slide. With time running short, we contrived one more desperate plan. It was decided that another driver and I would plow the road open to the switchbacks and drive back to the avalanche in our suburban station wagon. Since the switchback grade section of the road was still open, it was possible we could drive with reckless abandon from the avalanche to the lake and still catch the ferry. Plow we did and reached the suburban at the top of the switchbacks in record time. Unfortunately, the road was barely passable, and I determined I should also plow back to the stranded Bombardier with our snow plow, which also sat at the top of the switchbacks along with another small bus. I put the plow in six-wheel drive, started it up, and lowered the plow. With Tom Witt close behind, we headed back. Whoomp! I hit the first snow pile and coughed, the engine died. I tried again, but all those six wheels could push and the whining engine could pull was not enough to move the slushy snow. Once again, the old bulldozer was the only hope. I fired it up and prepared to rattle again down that beaten path. No sooner had I set my tracks in motion than once again the blade on my rebellious caterpillar began its relentless flapping. Once again I brought forth my battered tools for more fine-tuning while Tom decided it was best to brave the road without me. Several adjustments later, performance was restored to the blade lift and I was hot on Tom's heels. I got back to the avalanche just as the Suburban was heading out. I shut down the dozer and jumped in one of the wagon's open doors on the run for the final leg of our perilous journey to the now-waiting ferry. The recently plowed road was bad at best, but Tom held a generally true, though winding, course. When we reached the top of the open road at the switchbacks, I felt the odds were finally beaten and smiled a warm, inward smile of success. Oh no! What was that odd flapping sound where there used to be the hum of our left rear tire?
Oh, no!
It couldn't be. A flat tire driving on snow? My mind was staggered but not overcome, as I was certain it could be changed in time. Soon the tire tools and the spare were retrieved. We could have changed the tire and still made it to the ferry if only the jack had not been broken. I sat in the snow and hung my head in defeat. Word was received by radio that five of us, which did not include me, as someone had to fix machinery and move all the snow, could drive down the lake in a Forest Service boat. Since we couldn't stand in the middle of the road forever and stare at a flat tire, I jogged back up the hill to get the small bus to finish the trip while the others moved the wagon off the road. Another panting run to the top of the switchbacks, and I was back with the bus. After some fancy maneuvering in which I slide-swiped the Suburban, I managed to drive around its crippled presence. Unfortunately, in my fancy maneuvering, I busted one of the bus's tire chains. There was naught to do but remove it and throw it in the back. Though driving with one set of chains is indeed poor, it was traction enough to go downhill on a 10%. We made it to the dock at last, though the ferry had been gone for 2 hours. Five people were left at the dock for the Forest Service boat, and five of us, counting three people who had been left by the ferry, prepared for the torturous journey back to the village. There were three vehicles with chains at the lake we could have used to drive back to the last avalanche and our waiting bombardier on the other side. Two of them were small farm trucks, which would have been ideal. The other was a 35-foot-long school bus. One of the farm trucks had a dead battery. The other was so deeply mired in snow that it couldn't be moved. And of course, we opted for Plan C and took the 35-foot-long school bus. Things went well for about a mile as the old bus chugged and snorted up the road. But the third switchback proved to be the demise for our driver, Maynard Johnson, who had joined us at the dock. 35 feet is quite a length of bus to bend around a 120-degree turn, and it couldn't be done. After several charges at that hairpin turn, Maynard conceded. And we began a slow backwards descent. Somehow on that last fateful corner, the chains had ripped up one of the rear fender wheels, which set up a rattle to match my rattled nerves as we wound the bus backwards down the hill to the lake. What to do now? We decided to take on the hill from two directions. Maynard started walking up the 2 miles of switchbacks to get the snowplow to clear the road better on the way down, while the others and I stayed behind to jury-rig the busted chain on the small bus. We did a poor but passable repair job with spare chain links and bungee straps. It was dark when Maynard got down to the lake with the plow. With a sense of dull resolution and our lights on, we proceeded back up the hill with the plow in the lead. Home free, I thought to myself, until about halfway up the switchbacks. when suddenly the snowplow was engulfed in a geyser of steam. Though expecting the worst, I could not be fazed by this time. With toolbox in hand, I morosely ambled up to the wounded truck to survey the damage. It turned out to be only a loose fan belt, which had made the truck overheat. I tightened it under the light of a pen-like flashlight, which luckily Maynard's wife, Karen, had brought along when we were rolling again. We had nearly made it to the Bombardier when the snowplow gasped its last breath in a cloud of steam, 1/2 mile from our destination. The fan belt had broken, and we had no recourse but to hoof it back to our luggage with the waiting and the waiting snow track. What a relief it was to meet fellow villagers who had come to our aid at the last avalanche and to be loaded on our snow track and headed home at last. But no. Scarcely had we gone a mile than the biggest avalanche that a nightmare could conceive of towered in front of us. It had fallen sometime during the afternoon, and there we were between two avalanches in our Bombardier, trapped like rats. This last avalanche was at least 30 feet high and 100 yards across, with two smaller ones about 1/6 as large behind it. What could we do? We radioed the village for food and every able-bodied human being with a shovel that could be found to come out in our utility snow track to help us out. Of course, this snow track had also been broken down during the day, so our reinforcements set forth on skis. On this note, we set our weary wheels to digging a precarious road over this unforgiving mound. The best that could be said for this task was that progress, though horribly slow, was predictable. At least our reinforcements arrived on their At last, the reinforcements arrived on skis with shovels and food for us woebegone travelers. Scoop by scoop, a path was leveled, and even the logs in our way had to be cut by hand since the starter rope on our chainsaw busted after the first pull. To add a final insult to this drudgery, I was struck by a runaway bombardier. However, it did not complete its mission and run over me. More determined than ever, I pulled myself out of the snow and rejoined the others. With the extra food and help, we finally hacked our way over the last obstacles and a little after 9 p.m. made it back to the village at 9:30. I slept a fitful sleep that night, my only consolation being that if my luck had not changed by morning, at least it would be a different day. Down once a week to Lucerne to get supplies and mail, and then back to the village. Yes. Yes. Pretty crazy indeed. Yes. Well, here we are back at Holden Village. Yeah, Chelan, Washington, 98816. Yes. Yes. Another day at Christian Disneyland. It's another day at Christian Disneyland. Yes.
Well, I was down here on the road the other day. Yes, and a man came by and asked me, where does this road go? I answered him, it doesn't go anywhere. It stays right here. Pulling a chain down the road here. So I went up and I asked him why he was pulling the chain. He said, well, have you ever tried to push one? like the sweet farmer said when he was candling eggs, that was a good yoke. His tail caught in the lawnmower.
Oh.
Won't be long now. The short end of a long tail. I said he went to a retail store and got retail. Off. He saw a cop and he said, help, I'm being tailed. Yes, indeed. Well, there are many stories in the Bible that relate to life. Yes, for instance, tennis is mentioned in the Bible. Yes. It says in Exodus that Moses served in Pharaoh's court. Motorcycles are mentioned in the Bible. Yes. Joshua's triumph was heard throughout the land. Yes, indeed, yes. And then there's, the question of what stretches farther, skin or rubber. Yes, it's skin, because in the Bible it said that Moses hitched his ass to a tree and walked 2 miles. Did you hear there was going to be a big Hollywood production here tonight? And up in the sky, all the stars will be out. Well, I had a terrible nightmare last night. I dreamed I was chewing on a 6-pound marshmallow. And when I woke up, my pillow was gone. So I better bring a bale of hay with me to bed tonight to feed my nightmare. Norwegian school children say A, B, C, and ya.
This is Josh Post. That was Webb. I mean, it did that. Any more Holden stories?
Yeah, every morning.
I have a much shorter one, Holden. Chevy 2 burned down during the 68-69 winter. And in the spring of 69, it came up, and I was working mostly in the garage because there wasn't a mechanic. And so, you know, I take care of the minor maintenance and flat tires and oil changes and so on. And I got assigned to take a couple guys with me, and we scooped up what was left of Chalet 2 with scoop shovels and push brooms. And the only truck we had at the time to haul it away with is the 61 International, the one that's still here. And so we scooped it all up, and several loads, drove it through town here and up and over to the burn pile and so on, dumped it all out. And for, I can't remember how long thereafter, every morning I get up and I look up and down the street up here, and I have 3 flat tires one morning, 7 another morning, 5 another morning, and I had to change them all. Then I finally looked at that truck, 61 International truck. Somebody rebuilt the bed correctly, except the bores didn't quite come out even. There was a crack about an inch wide clear down the middle, and I had been planting burned nails.
Oh. Oh.
I had to fix all my my record was 11 flat tires one morning.
Oh.
Any other stories, but it doesn't have to be about Holden, anything if we want to tell. Yeah.
My grandmother, one time, while she was alive, she felt really kind of close to the issues of older people, and so she made a yearly donation to the Alzheimer's Foundation. Well, one year, her letter was returned to her. It seems that she put an Easter steel instead of a stamp on it.
Oh.
Donation to the Alzheimer's.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have a grandma story too. My grandma lived very long, and when she was 100 years old, she had a hysterectomy because she had cancer. And so she was getting ready to go back to her apartment, her retirement apartment. And she had a friend at her retirement apartment. And you know, so she said she was getting ready to go back to her apartment. You know, people who wonder what I was here for. And you know, I think they think that Martin and I may have had, you know, some funny business going on. And so, you know, it always goes down with a little bit of sense of humor. So when they asked me what I was doing here, I'm just going to tell them, well, you know, I decided I don't want any more children. I have a million grandma stories.
That's great. Did the mail speak up?
I can tell a bear story.
Okay.
Okay. The way to, like when you're out hiking, it's good to have a whistle and some mace, a little bear mace, that you keep away. But when you're hiking along and you see scat that's full of berries and that sort of thing, you know, it's probably a brown bear. But if you see a grizzly bear scat, it's gonna have a it's gonna smell like mace and it'll have a whistle in it.
Oh.
Oh.
Well,
yeah.
Well, I've been afraid of the water, and any kind of a boat smaller than a ferry was a very suspicious vehicle. So Jim convinced me to go out in this powerboat. And so we go out and we come back and we're walking around and it's been 2.5 hours. And he finally turns around to me and says, I really think you can take your life preserver off. I don't think you're going to drown on dry land.
Well, I've got a funeral story.
Get the clergy together and then start
wedding and funeral stories. But this happens frequently in my family. I had an uncle who died at age 89 at the end of July. And his son, my cousin, who's also a pastor, my uncle's pastor was not available, and so we ended up having to do the service. And part of it was kind of cool because we baptized my uncle's great-granddaughter at the funeral, which was kind of neat. But part of what we were remembering, and I ended up having to preach at it, and I remembered the story my uncle had just told us a couple years before that nobody had heard. He told it after his wife died about 2.5 years ago. And they lived on Whidbey Island in Puget Sound, beautiful place, on Holmes Harbor, beautiful view. And they had next to them, two women lived next to them for many, many years. And this one woman, her partner, died. And she was cremated. And they weren't religious at all, but she wanted to spread the ashes in Holmes Harbor out in front of their houses. So she asked my aunt and uncle if they would help her do this because she knew they were church folk and religious and all that. So in one day in March, and my uncle would have been in his early 80s and the other two women in their late 70s. And they went out into the rowboat in March, and it was a little windy in Holmes Harbor. And also there were a couple white caps, my uncle said. So he's trying to row the boat to get the boat into the wind so that when the woman was sitting with the ashes at the end of the boat, when she dumps them, it's downwind, you know. And he said, well, it was hard to do and he said, there's some water coming to the boat, so it's kind of row a bit, bail a bit, row a bit, bail a bit. So this is all going on, getting rougher out there. And all the time this is going, my Aunt Elsie is sitting in the bow of the boat, playing her accordion and singing Amazing Grace. So we do my uncle's funeral. So that's the story. And I told that story at the funeral. And then we go to the grave, to a little baby cemetery on Whidbey Island. And they start bringing his casket over onto the... Have you been around a grave? They have this little bar thing, and it's got straps on it, and there's little things that stop it. So, they're bringing it over, and all of a sudden, the west end of the grave starts collapsing in. And a couple of the pallbearers start going down. The casket starts going down, the ball came full of sand. The casket, one side, the funeral person tried to release the rolling straps thing, but one side didn't go. So the casket's going into the grave sideways. Right at this exact moment, my uncle's grandson said, it's okay, he liked to sleep on his side.
My dad had for years been a machinist, and he belonged to the International Association of Machinists. And for some reason, whenever he thought about his own funeral, he told my mom, he said, you probably won't be able to get enough pallbearers. He said, so you just call the union hall, and they'll take care of everything. So this was just kind of a family story. Everybody knew the drill. So we got the call one day that Dad was terminal and I'd better get back to St. Louis. So I got on the plane, and on the way back, Dad passed away. So I land, and my brother's there, and other relatives are there, and Mother is sitting in the front room organizing the funeral. So I piped up and I said, well, Mom, do you have enough pallbearers? And she says, I've got it all taken care of. No problem. So we proceed to the funeral home, and the funeral director calls all the pallbearers together. One too many. Mother had not counted right, so Dad had too many pallbearers. So now what do you do? And you look around and you say, which one of these people am I going to say can't be a pallbearer? And I was just scared spitless because they were all good family friends. And finally I picked the husband of a woman that Mother had worked with very closely for years. But she was a very sensitive lady. And I was telling her husband that he wasn't going to be a pallbearer. Turns out he was just really relieved because he had hurt his arm. earlier. Well, I went out and told Mother, and Mother told me it'd be just fine, and she laughed, and we got on with the funeral, but Dad, one thing you called her.
There's stories, anything, actually.
Nothing has stories.
Yeah. No?
No.
I can tell a story. Well, how about Sunday school? That usually works. Somebody else reading back there? Okay, we're torture. We had the lesson was the baptism of Jesus. And the teacher was telling them the story and about how the sky opens and the dove descends and the beams come down and the voice comes out. And she was telling the kids, this is such a great story. She said, what would you say if you were standing on the banks and the sky opened and a dove descended and this big voice came out? And this one kid said, do you do parties?
We had a Sunday school program, and my colleague was doing kids' time with all the little kids up in front. There was probably 50, 75 little kids up front. And she started the kids' time by saying, so what's different about church today? What is different about today? And this little boy said, my daddy's here.
My dad, I think this is a funny response to telemarketers. He doesn't like telemarketers. He's 90 years old, so whenever a telemarketer calls and they say, how are you today, Mr. Sanderson? He says, well, I can still sit up and take nourishment.
Same vein. My father is 90, and he was sitting down to eat supper. You know, he fixed his supper and sat down to eat it, and the telemarketer called. So she didn't know that, so he picks the phone up and talks to the guy. The guy started asking how he is and everything else. Dad realized right away it's the telemarketer. And he says, well, just a minute. He says, tell me your phone number and what time you sit down to supper, and I'll call you.
No, I was just raising thumbs up.
Oh, thumbs up, yeah. Well, the only remind me of another of Fritz Norsted, you can see pictures of him on the timeline in there. He was an interim director of Holden Village in 1977 and 78. And Fritz was a very interesting person. He was actually a lady who did a whole lot for Lutherans in North America, including founding Park Ridge. Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois, which is a big place, and he did raise money for clinics in Africa and in Asia, did a whole lot of stuff for really the common humanity of us all, really great that way. But Fritz was also a character, and so was his wife Gertrude, who just died just in this last year, and Fritz died about 15 years ago. But Fritz was a very big guy too, and he would tell a story about when they were first married, and he was first a pastor, and they were somewhere in Iowa, Marshalltown or someplace like that, and the congregation had just finished, it was a brand new parsonage, and they had just finished it when they moved in. And so the people in the congregation had not yet seen the parsonage. So they moved in, Fritz's first Sunday, he gets up and he says to the congregation, come on over anytime if you want to see the parsonage. Well, so of course, sure enough, Monday morning, knock, 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 and here's a bunch of ladies. And so they want to see the parsonage. So Fritz welcomes them in and starts showing them around, and Gertrude's sort of in the background making coffee and things. And then Fritz takes them upstairs to see the upstairs, and Gertrude's coming down the stairs, and she just whispers to Fritz and says, if you're going to take them into our bedroom, you better pick your underwear up off the floor. So Fritz dashes ahead
into the bedroom, and Gertrude had nailed his underwear. He never did it again. In the same year, there was another E.L. teacher in the same town, and Gertrude, this is in the 1930s, and Gertrude had to learn how to be a good pastor's wife. So the other pastor's wife was teaching her how to do this. You can already get a clue that Gertrude never was a good pastor. Anyway, this is in the days when for pastor's conferences, they'd all get together and like they'd all room in one big room because they had to save money, you know. So they'd all get one hotel room and like five guys would sleep in the same hotel room. And so they got themselves in a situation where Gertrude had to pack for Fritz. She normally wouldn't do that, but the other woman had said, "I always do this for my husband." And she said, you just get in a situation where you can't lie. And just so Gertrude did pack for Fritz. And she sewed lace and satin and all kinds of things on all his clothes. When she told the story, she said she had to, which was the purpose, it was so poofy. She had to just squish the clothes in order to close the suitcase. So, you know exactly what happens when Fritz opens his suitcase in this room with five other guys. All this stuff poofs out. And Fritz said, years later, he'd see people at conferences, like he was the main speaker or something, and they'd say, "Hey, still wearing lace on your a story, and David Wee, maybe you know this story, about a guy named Fjellsted, who was the vice president, no, that was the pastor, Anna Fjellsted is who he married, Paul somebody, who was vice president of St. Olaf, like in the 30s or the early 40s, and he had already buried two wives, and he married, do you know this story? Have you heard this before? Anyway, he married a woman named Anna Fjellsted, who was in her 50s and had never been married. And her father was the oldest, gets to the 90-year-old. He was the oldest living pastor in the ELC. He was about 95. And he had about five sons who were all pastors. And she was his only daughter. Right? And so it was at St. John's in Northfield. And everybody was there, I guess. And Fritz, I guess, was there. And so they decided what they were going to do is sort of trot out the old man for the main vows. So they get out there. And so... I wish I could remember his name. So he looks to her and says, to the guys, and Paul, whatever his name was, "Do you take Anna Fjellsted to be your loving wife?" And I'm going to hold yada, yada, yada. And then he looks at the bride, his daughter. You know, the last thing he did for her was her confirmation, you know.
Oh, dear.
And with tears in his eyes, he said, "Anna Fjellsted, do you renounce the devil?"
Josh's dad. And I don't know, were you alive at that
yes.
time? How old were you when this took
place? Well, too young to go on the water slide.
Too young to go on the water slide, right. Okay, well, I have Josh's brother-in-law there. So my daughter Joy, she's up with the kids right now. But Joy and her older brother and I, the whole family, we decided we were going to go to this water slide. It was about a mile away from the house. And so we got dressed and we got ready to go, and the kids were excited to go to the water slide and everything. And we walk in and buy the tickets, and my wife, Nancy, she's holding on to Josh because he was just small at the time. And there was a bleachers with about as many people as you are in the bleachers. And the two kids are there, and I say, "Now, hand your your towel to your mother and take those shirts off. So we could go in. And so I'm taking my shirts off. And I take my shirts off and I'm still instructing. And then I take my swim trunks off. And Joy comes up to me and she says, "Dad, are you going in your underwear?" And I'm standing in front of bleachers like this. And so then, if that wasn't enough, you know, I hadn't embarrassed myself enough. So my son, he's old enough to go, Matt, he's old enough to go on the water slide. But Joy, what, 3, 4 years old? So I'm walking right there, and she says, "You have to go with me." And I'm like, "Oh, of course." And they had these little rubber things that you'd sit on to go on down the pads to go on the water slide. So I get the rubber thing, and I sit her between my legs, and we're going down there, and all of a sudden the pad goes out. So you know, I know there's people behind me, you know, so I go down the water slide, and I get down, and everything's fine, and everything, and my pad comes back, and I take her hand and we're going to walk up and go again. And my wife comes over to the fence. "Don, Don, Don." I said, "What?" She said, "Your swim trunks." And this rough surface ripped. Oh, and they're hanging down. So, you know, I take the hand. And they were ready to go again. I said, "Well, okay, we got to go home." Now, there's another story that took place. It's a horse.
We're just about the end of our time here. One more, I thought if we could get another story, and then maybe I thought, could Wes give us a little, as we go out on the highways and byways?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now?
Sure, you can come up.
Yes. Okay. Well, yes, we will see you all again along the highways and byways of Holden Village. Remember, Holden's always good for a change and a rest. We'll take your change and give you the rest. Yes. Yes. And as you go out from Holden Village, remember not to stick your hand out too far. It might go home in another car.
Thank you, Wes, for being here. Thank you.